I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. Today is the last day of May, May 31st, 2017. This is the next to the last meeting of this committee. And my hope is that we'll get through most of the bills on our agenda today, but we won't get through all of them, I'm sure. We're still waiting for paperwork on a couple of them, and then who knows. So, Senator Brzezinski?
So, Mr. Chair, I'm assuming your comments are tomorrow will be the last day for us to be actually hearing bills, but we as a committee are going to continue to have show and tell, right?
Yes, that is correct. And we have some fascinating shows. We have fascinating shows to tell you about. All right. Okay. So speaking of fascinating, let's have a public hearing on House Bill 2099A. This is an issue that, some of us are more familiar with than others, but it's been with us for a number of years, and we are trying to take a stab at resolving it, finally.
One more time.
Yeah. So, Beth, why don't you just tell us what the bill does, and while you're doing that, if Tracy Rotten and Mark Landauer could come up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2099A addresses conditions related to time extensions for municipal water permits, for certain municipal water permits, as described in the bill. There are a number of amendments posted on OLIS, which address the same topic in different ways. And I'll be happy to go into any in more detail if you'd like, but there's a fair amount of detail.
That's great. Okay, Tracy and Mark, you want to give us a little background?
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair Dumbro, members of the committee. For the record, Tracy Rutten with the League of Oregon Cities. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on House Bill 2099A. The League of Oregon Cities and Special Districts Association introduced this bill in an effort to provide some form of relief and a legislative fix to a 2013 Court of Appeals decision, which retroactively applied what are known as fish persistence conditions to certain municipal water right permits. I want to make it very clear today that the heart of this issue is about existing drinking water supply for about 10 to 15 impacted communities. Failure to remedy the court's application of retroactive conditioning for these permits means that these communities will have access to less water than they have had historically. Some of them for up to 20 years. It is a clawback of existing supply that they have demonstrated they need in order to support current populations and existing businesses in those communities. And while we are certainly concerned about whether our members have adequate drinking water for the future, all of these impacted permits are looking at a hardline reduction, again, of their past and current water use. So for a little very brief background, because the background on this one is extensive, and I won't go through all the details, but essentially, since the existence of fish persistence conditions, which were enacted through the passage of a bill during the 2005 legislative session, which was House Bill 3038, the Oregon Water Resource Department adopted rules and provided communication to our members, the municipalities, that the application of those conditions to the undeveloped portion of their permit, so by undeveloped, we mean essentially water that had not been put to use as of that time, would occur in on a prospective basis. So in other words, to date or at the time of processing a future post-2005 application for an extension of time on their permits. Administrative rules were adopted by the Water Resources Commission to support that prospective application of the statute. Many permits, which again at the time of passage of House Bill 3038 in 2005, there was a backlog of about 200 permits at the time. Again, the result of that backlog was due to quite a bit of uncertainty in litigation and rulemaking during a number of years, leading from the late 1990s to 2005. So when they had that backlog, they began processing permits again in 2006, following passage of the bill, and they were able to process about 140 of those permits. What's important to note is that as those 140 permits were processed, they did receive the benefit of the law and the administrative rules that had been adopted. So they were conditioned, but on a going forward basis, where essentially the Water Resource Department would contact the municipality and say, we're ready to process your application. Tell us how much water you have used to date. that quantity of water would be reported. The undeveloped portion that had not yet been used would then be subject to fish persistence conditions based on what ODFW determined. So essentially, we're dealing with a challenge where we've got a number of permits that received the benefit of the law prior to the court decision. When we learned of the court's decision in 2013, we were aware that there were about 60 permits that had not yet been processed of the 200. Since that time, we've been able to gather a lot of additional data to understand that out of the 60, about 10 to 15 of them had developed water prior to that court decision that would be subject then to retroactive conditioning. As you are likely aware, we've attempted to pass a legislative fix to this issue now for three sessions. The heart of the matter really is that these communities had to make real-time investments in infrastructure and increase capacity to supply drinking water to their citizens and the businesses that rely on that water supply. It is very frustrating to the communities that they made these decisions believing that they would have access to the water, only to essentially have the rug pulled out from underneath them due to the court decision. It's very difficult to operate as good stewards of ratepayer and taxpayer dollars and to make sound investments that can be later compromised due to a moving policy target. So the Ian Gross version of the bill, as passed by the House, indicated that water that was developed prior to the court's decision in 2013 would not be subject to the fish persistence conditions. It also implemented a new process by which a municipality would need to meet with ODFW to receive information on potential fish concerns so that the municipality could make informed decisions to mitigate and minimize impacts, potential impacts to fish. The concept was intended to recognize that in terms of statewide water use, all municipal water serving over 3 million people accounts for 6% of the total water diverted in the state. There are approximately 1,700 municipal permits in Oregon. We're talking about 10 to 15 of those permits that are caught up in this issue. So the process in the A and Gross version recognizes that we are a piece of a much larger water supply puzzle, and it would allow for what we believe is a more holistic approach to balance fish and human consumption needs. I just want to quickly mention Hood River because I know that it's been a topic of a lot of conversation. The A and Gross version takes into consideration that the city invested $30 million in a new water distribution pipeline to replace a very leaky pipeline that hadn't been upgraded since the 1920s. The city worked with USDA Rural Development, a federal agency, who provided funding for the design work of the project. That design work was done in 2001, so again, 4 years before fish persistence was ever in ORS. The agency indicated to the city that they should build that new 24-mile pipeline to account for the full capacity of the city's water right, because when you are investing taxpayer and ratepayer dollars in infrastructure, you should be doing so for the long term. It makes no sense to invest in that infrastructure for a current population or even a population 10 years out. And that's what the city of Hood River did. They invested for a 75-plus year timeline or time frame going out for that infrastructure. The challenge here is that our state policy doesn't always support these types of future investments. I think this issue has been highlighted through the court's decision and also through this bill. The city invested $30 million total, $9 million of which was federal agency grant funding on the new pipeline. Again, a lot of this was in the works as many of these things were changing, and they had no knowledge then at the time that they would be held up in this retroactive conditioning. What the A and Gross version of the bill aims to do is grandfather in the investment that they made for the capacity of their system. They weren't running the water through the pipeline before the court decision. But they feel that the investment they made is worth something that should be protected. So this is a tough issue. I don't think that I will get into the amendments. I'm going to leave that to Mark Landauer, but I am happy to answer any questions you have and appreciate your time today.
Hey, Mark.
Good afternoon, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. My name is Mark Landauer. I'm here on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. I think Tracy's done a very good job giving you the history, and I'm going to just give you a very, very brief overview of the amendments that are before you. The first amendment that I'd like to describe is the A-10 amendment, and that sort of is a furtherance of this concept of voluntary strategies to develop those strategies to mitigate impacts to fish. We have worked in the last 24 hours very well, actually last little more than 12, 14 hours with our clients to try to understand and digest the A-10 amendment. And our clients are very concerned that it would open up a host of new avenues for litigation against our members. In particular, on page 10 under 6B, which can be found, forgive me, between lines 13 and 17, we are concerned that the parties may disagree with a department or the extent to which a community has been able to reduce consumption of water for municipal use, increased water quantity, or improved water quality during the time of years that those results are relevant for reducing potential effects on the water use for fish. There is the challenge is that there is no way to measure for success. And I want to just briefly describe that I have one particular client who over the last several years has spent over $2.7 million in litigation and mitigation efforts as a result of being sued, and they just don't have any water certainty even to this date. So their concerns and other concerns about opening new avenues to litigation is very real. On the other hand, the A8 and now the A11, which has just been posted, would create a date certain of June 29, 2005. One has an emergency clause. I believe that's the 8 or the 11. Mm-hmm. The challenge with those approaches is it creates distinct winners and losers, all of whom, I might add, followed the rules and relied on the advice of the Water Resources Department. The three communities that would be spared with either the 8 or 11 would be Sandy, Carlton, and Bend. There may be a few others, but according to the data that I have, those would be the two that would be in a safe zone. Whereas the communities who would face curtailment of currently used water, water that is running through pipes today, would be Hood River, Tri-City Water District, Philomath, North Clackamas County Water, Cottage Grove, Detroit, and Lakeside Water District. So that's a brief description of the two amendments that, or I should say three amendments that are before you.
Mark, let me follow up on your last point. Actually, before I do, let me just say to everyone that we have had a work group that's been meeting, and that's where these amendments are coming from. You know, I think the discussions have all been in good faith, and this is a difficult issue, because, there are winners and losers, and that it's kind of inevitable in this sort of process. And we want to minimize the losers if possible, while still, respecting the underlying need to protect fish as well as provide water to those who need it. So, Mark, you gave us some of the winners and losers under the -8-11 amendments. What if we do nothing? Who are the winners and losers there?
Senator Dembro, members of the committee, in that case, there would be a retroactive curtailment for the fish, for the persistence of fish, dating back to each community's last approved completion or extension. So, for example, if I may, Senator, the city that would probably get hurt the most is the city of Philomath. The reason for that is that their last completion date dates back to 1993, and they have developed water since that date. So my initial take on your question would be all 10 to 15 of those communities would lose some portion of their water that they had developed since their last completion date.
Okay, thanks. Senator Bertrier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I'm getting this right, the way this bill came over from the House would fix all the cities if we left it that way, correct?
Well, that's a fair question. Again, Representative Senator Dembro, Senator Bertschinger, the way the bill came over created quite a bit of attention by some environmental interests, particularly for a provision that is contained in the present bill related to Hood River. Bill would further provide voluntary strategies that we still have concerns would open up avenues for litigation to our members. Again, those would be voluntary, but there are avenues by which some could take either the Water Resources Department, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, or the actual municipal water supplier to court, challenging whether or not their voluntary efforts were sufficient enough to mitigate any impacts to fish.
Any other questions for these two? Senator Rubin.
Yeah, not as much a question as a statement. This has been a bill that actually, it's the reason I came to, one of the reasons I came to the legislature. Because the Coos Bay North Bend Water Board was in a issue with the water right on 10 Mile Creek, and the City of Lakeside didn't think we should take their water, even though it had already left their lake, and pump it into the sand dunes and for a water source that we had. So we were in litigation for a number of years, and I decided I was going to run for the legislature, and one of my first bills and issues was going to be making sure that cities had a 20-year water right, because we had these five-year water rights, and it's hard to perfect them in 5 years, and we don't need them, and we know we have growth expectations, so we need to have a water supply, and almost all the surface water had been absorbed. The Fish and Wildlife put in water rights for almost everything that was on surface water outside of the stuff that had already been done. So we wanted to protect our water right, and we were doing pretty well, and then it came to an appeals judge, and we had, I think, 1,000 friends joined in with Lakeside, and they said that we were going to lose our water right because we had not perfected in 5 years, and we showed them the information that showed that we had been in litigation for 5 years, and the judge said, well, there's no provision for being in litigation, therefore, you didn't do it in 5 years, you lose. I thought that was crazy. So we came and we wrote this bill, and we had a long conversation, a lot of work groups, came up with a solution, which we thought was pretty good. We apparently, there was conversation in the meeting about fish persistence, but I would say that nothing came in the bill that talked about fish persistence. It went through the House, went through the Senate, and the Senate carrier of that one was Mr. Ringo, and so he put it on the record that fish persistence was one of the things that should be considered. And when the court case that was filed in 99 over this whole thing finally got to fruition in 2011 or 12, whenever it was, 13, they could not find any record in the bill, so they went to what was the foundation for the bill, which meant they went back to the record of the Senate presentation. Ringo was the presenter. He said fish persistence was a part of it. The court ruled that because of that statement, not in the bill, but on the record in the Senate, fish persistence was now a part of what that bill was. That led us to this conversation, because in the meantime, once the bill had gone through, we had rules promulgated by Water Resources, and people started trying to make up for all these years of no water rights being distributed. The Water Resources believed that it was fair, because there were so many water rights and they needed to get through them, that it would be better to do it by watershed as opposed to in order in which they came, which has always been the history of Water Resources, to take them in the order in which they came. They decided, no, it would be much more efficient if we did it by watershed. So they started issuing water rights. That resulted in a number of people getting water rights until we had a final decision which said, sorry, you have to do fish persistence. The water rights that had already been approved were approved. The water rights that hadn't been approved, which may have come in much earlier than the ones that were approved, were not approved. At that point, we started this conversation about two sessions ago, in which I felt that
fairness dictated that if the water resources and everybody else who was in, most everybody else that was in the meeting of that bill had come up with a decision about how it should be handled, and now we found out that what we had decided was wrong, that we should at least let all of those people who had their application in before the judgment by the Supreme Court, because they followed the instructions of the water resources, they should at least be given a chance to get their water rights done. One district in particular had, I shouldn't say game the system, I guess I'll say one of those water right people had done some things that made it a little frustrating for more than a couple of us sitting on this panel, which didn't help the situation, but most everybody else was doing it in accordance with what they thought was right. And at the end of the day, we're here now because we can't agree. Most of those people could go through the water right. Fish persistence probably will not be a problem. But there will be some that would be affected and will lose water rights to water that they have been using for their communities. For a person who was on a water board who really tried to make sure that people had water, that's very frustrating. And infrastructure is expensive. People have put it in. To not be able to use it is extremely frustrating for those of us who are in that part of the thing. I understand fish are important because they're really important to people who live on the coast. Fish is a big part of our industry and all those kinds of things, so we don't want to harm them. But I wish there was a way to come up with what I would believe is a rational solution and move forward. So far, it doesn't seem like we've been able to get there through many different people taking on work groups, three of whom are sitting on this panel.
Yes.
I get so frustrated that I just felt like I needed to say.
No, thank you. Thank you very, very much for that. You know, I will say one thing I've learned about this issue is you would like to think that the historical record and people's memories of it were as clear, as limpid as spring water. But in fact, they're sometimes as murky as a slough. And so I think we'll hear different recollections about what happened in 2005, what happened between 2005 and 2013, et cetera.
And Chair Deborah.
Our hope is to try to figure out a way to move forward.
Yes. If I may, I think that that very point articulates why we're so interested in getting it right and avoiding ambiguous language that lands us back in this hearing room again 5 or 10 years from now. So we would very much not like to touch this issue again.
Ever again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you both very much. Lisa Brown, would you come up, Jack? Lisa, thanks for coming. Water Watch has been playing a lead role on behalf of the environmental community.
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lisa Brown, here testifying on behalf of Water Watch of Oregon. We are opposed to the House Bill 2099A engrossed as it came over from the House. I know there's a lot to get through today, and I have put in my written testimony, I've highlighted sort of some of the key problems that we see in that bill. One thing I didn't put in there that I want to add here on the record is, you know, we don't like the payment in lieu of peace, because we feel that really this is about addressing the needs of the fish, and we don't think that really gets to it. So I did want to add that. Really, the key problem with that bill from our perspective is that it replaces these fish persistence conditions, which have really proven workable. You know, no water rights are lost. We're really talking about modest reductions in diversions at times when listed fish need the water. So what the bill does is replaces those conditions with, an unclear sort of strategies for voluntary action that lack clear mechanisms to ensure implementation and effectiveness. And these sort of rollbacks, as we would term them, they have real effects on Oregon rivers, you know, including the Lake Branch Creek, the West Fork of the Hood River, lots of rivers around the state. So this is a very important issue for us. And, you know, it's the universe of permits affected by this bill has gotten smaller and smaller as more permits have gone through the system. You know, these really have proven workable, you know, the conditions. And it really still is our view, after extensive analysis of the remaining permits, that the best strategy is to work on the effective permits in a creative manner and find a solution under existing law that addresses both the city's need for water and the fish's need for water as well. And I think I would just leave it at that unless anybody has questions. I could go on all day, of course, about this stuff.
Yes, Senator Bertrew.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, as we go through this process, and it looks like there may be winners and losers, some people maybe get a better deal. Do you have any advice for someone like me that has to address the communities when they ask why we don't have access to the water we need?
Senator Dembro, Senator Bertschiger, you know, again, based on extensive analysis, no city is going to lose access to water that it needs under existing fish persistence standards. I think for every city, you know, there's a creative solution out there that would work. The curtailment formulas really are fairly modest. And honestly, it's not in Water Watch's interest to have fish, you know, protection standards that take water away from cities that they need for drinking water. I mean, that's not in any fish advocate's interest either. So, I mean, I guess what I would say is, if a city comes to you with that concern, you know, feel free to reach out to me, and I'm happy to kind of walk through the situation and figure out what's going on, I guess is what I would say. Thank you for the question.
Yes, Vice Chair Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Cities have an obligation to lay out their growth for the future. They have an obligation to provide infrastructure to those people that want to move to the city. And without that obligation, cities would never grow and expand. So we run into a basic conflict, as I see it, as to, do we protect the water resources and protect the ability of fish to move up and down the stream, or do we allow a city to perfect a water right that they were given years and years and years ago? Do you see that there would be a compatible balance that could be reached so that both could be attained at the same time?
Chair Dembro, Senator Olson, yeah, we believe that, in fact, we believe that House Bill 3038 charted that path for Oregon to say, let's let cities develop these old undeveloped water rights, but let's do it in a way that maintains the persistence of listed salmon and steelhead. And, you know, we very much believe that that path is out there, and that's what we should be trying to do. I mean, we should be trying to figure out how the cities can meet their reasonable water needs, accounting for growth, while also, you know, protecting our iconic salmon and steelhead. And, you know, there are a lot of examples where, you know, there's sort of plenty of water to go around. There are leasing strategies. There are other ways to do this that don't involve dewatering streams that have, you know, prized listed fish in them. So, yeah, we do believe that path can be charted, and that's what we should be doing.
Yeah, before you do, let me just jump in. I mean, one of the things that we talked about as we were working on what came to be the -A10 amendments were, you know, was that cities would develop strategies once they were told by ODF&W what the challenges were, and that they would need to plan for fish persistence, but they were given the ability to come up with voluntary strategies for how to reach those goals, and that would include a whole variety of strategies, including conservation, including leasing water from elsewhere, in some cases moving water around within the municipality, right? So you didn't need to take so much from this spring. If you had a spring that was less vulnerable, you could take from there. So those are the kinds of things that the A10s are asking cities to do in an attempt to meet both of those goals of protecting fish and providing water for cities. It does put requirements on cities that they come up with such strategies and follow them, actually, and that those strategies need to make a difference. That's sort of the basic premise behind the A10s. The challenge there does become, as I think Tracy and Mark articulated, there is some wiggle room there, which is good. We like flexibility, but that could make one vulnerable to lawsuits down the road. That's the challenge. I'm sorry.
No problem. Follow up. So we look at the city of Hood River in particular, mm-hmm. because they decided that they were going to expand where we needed this much growth. We need to fix the infrastructure that was in terrible disrepair. So when this project began, they decided that this would be an acceptable point of diversion that they could draw water from. Then in the future, the rules changed and said, oh, by the way, you need to meet these requirements and those requirements, which makes it extremely difficult because most of us can't view the future. We don't have the crystal ball to see what's going to happen. So how can you, how do you explain to a city such as Hood River that has invested millions of dollars in the infrastructure to make a system work that their system can't work and won't work and will never be allowed to work?
Chair Dembro, Senator Olson. A few things about Hood River, and I know I think the Warm Springs Tribe is here, and they can talk, I think, more specifically about the fish impacts. But, you know, at the time that the pipe was being planned or built, or I'm not exactly sure on the timeline, but basically, you know, in the 2000s, 2004, 2005, that timeline, you know, the city had water permits that expired in 1998 and 2000. They had filed for extensions of time, which they knew they needed in order to basically secure the entitlement to further develop those water rights. So they did not have that entitlement at that time. In early 2005, after the Coos Bay North Bend case came out, litigation happened, they then asked to put those extension applications on administrative hold. They told the state to stop processing those applications. So it's at that time when the city is continuing to invest in the pipe. And so that's a concern. You know, that is a concern when people make investments based on a water right that's in a permit stage and subject to further conditioning. So that's one point. The other point is if you look at the Hood River Water Management and Conservation Plan, and you look at the numbers for what Hood River has already said that they've developed, which would not be subject to fish persistence, and you look at their water right certificates, you know, they already have sort of free and clear of fish persistence based on the numbers that they've provided, which, of course, are subject to change, that they've provided in their extension applications. They already have enough water sort of free and clear of fish persistence to meet their max day demand at full build-out of their urban growth boundary, which they project would happen in 2058. So I think that, you know, they have water that can run through the pipe. Can they exempt all their undeveloped water from fish persistence under, you know, the base, the 2013 date or 2005 or existing law? No. They would have some fish persistence conditions, which are critical for listed fish in that system, absolutely critical. But does the pipe become unusable, or can they not meet their UGB demands? No, I don't think the numbers support that. So,
follow up.
Yeah,
I find it interesting because Hood River sits right on a huge river that has an abundance of water. But for those cities that don't, they're in a situation all their own where they're dictated to by environmental groups stating that you must keep this much water in stream so that fish can do what fish do, but it really puts confines on what they can do as a city. They can't grow. They don't want people to water the lawn. They want conservation, which is all wonderful and fine. But how do you handle those cities the Philomath, I believe, was mentioned. How do you handle those cities that don't have, if need be, a huge river that they could draw from, which Hood River won't do, but, you know, they have a finite source of water. What do you do with those cities?
Chair Denbrough, Senator Olson, you know, the issue of small cities on small rivers and relying on small rivers for the creeks for their water supply has been a problem, you know, long before fish persistence came along. I think for Philomath in particular, if you look at their portfolio of water rights and their ability to intertie with Corvallis and things like that, again, we can, Philomath can have the water that it needs, and we can not put at risk the listed fish in the Marys River. I mean, that's where I think the analysis is there.
Okay. Lisa, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For coming. Okay, we have Thomas Mosher. Is it Reed Marbet?
Yes.
And Tom Wolf, please. Is Reed here? Oh, Reed, why don't you come up, please? Thank you. Thomas, you want to start?
Fairly brief. Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, for the record, name is Thomas Mosher. I'm here representing Central Oregon Land Watch, and we just want to join with Water Watch and the other organizations who oppose this bill. We're deeply concerned with the attempt to roll back protections for vital waterways, and weakening the hard fought for protections only opens the systems to gamesmanship. And we agree with them that they should we agree with Water Watch that we should look to the solutions under current law.
Thank you, Tom.
Chairman Denbrough, members of the committee, if it pleases the committee, my name is Reed Marvin, and I'm here representing the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs Reservation. You have my written testimony, I think, and so I won't just read it to you. I'll encapsulate a little bit. As you can see by the testimony that the tribe has a significant interest in the Hood River. And, of course, this interest way predates you and us here and the state of Oregon. It was an essential environment for two of the Confederated tribes, the Warm Springs and the Wasco tribes. And they lived on the fish, and then you've seen the pictures even around this capital of the fish nets and that environment. That was their substance. They are fish culture tribes. Now we're arrived in, of course, the 21st century. The tribe has done everything it can to work cooperatively with all interest groups wherever it has an interest, and this is especially true in the Hood River, where they have participated with substantial funds to assist with improving habitat, improving fish flows, et cetera, mostly things like fish ladders, bypass flows, et cetera, to allow fish to reach their natural habitat. And this has been an effort of about 20 years now, 15 at least. They have an office in the Hood River. They work right in the community. They meet with the irrigation districts, et cetera. The problem we have here, and I do have a significant amount of sympathy, and the tribe does, for the cities in general. They're really into a corner. And as we say, bad law makes bad results. And there's a couple of cases which just didn't turn out the way you would think. And the result is the cities are often in a corner. I think the testimony of Water Watch and the available flows, maybe Hood River is better off than many of the other communities. But in the Hood River, and especially in the West Fork and the tributary, what's called Lake Branch Creek, turn out to be, ironically, and I really mean ironically, an essential piece of fish habitat. And this good, clear, clean, cold water that's going to the residents of the city of Hood River, and I can understand why this water is extremely important to Hood River, to the city of Hood River. Unfortunately, it's a competition. And it turns out that, and setting aside the Endangered Species Act and any of that, it turns out to be an essential habitat for a number of species. And if removed, it could significantly damage the populations. And we have provided in our testimony some facts and figures that you will see. We constantly are measuring, evaluating. If the committee is interested, I can forward further analysis by the biologists of the tribe who have assessed the fish runs in that area. Our approach has been in the Wood River Basin and in other places where the tribe has an interest in understanding not just what a city needs or not just what the fish needs, but how can we balance the fish flows, the fish demands, the habitat requirements with the city's ability to get the water they need for current and future uses. We believe that's possible here because the period of the year when the fish need the water are not necessarily the time of year when the cities might need their most water. Now, I obviously am an attorney and I'm counsel of a firm. I should have announced that at the beginning, Carnot Peterson in Bend, Oregon. And we have a lot of clients for whom we have drafted water management conservation plans. And in every water management and conservation plan, the municipality or whoever is filing the plan, whether it's an irrigation district or a quasi-municipal operation, a resort, needs to have a plan for what they will do during periods of the year when water might not be available in its full amount. Things so simple as you don't water your lawns, so complex is that you find alternate sources, you try to develop storage. And I think that it's possible for the in-stream flows to be protected in Lake Branch Creek and the West Fork at levels which will continue to allow the fish to survive and prosper and the city to be able to use its water very flexibly. We don't necessarily oppose the bill, as I said in my testimony. What we oppose is the implication of water use on the fish cultures. And that's why we have, I had to mark the square on your old chart, and I had to put oppose, but I don't really mean that. We're really neutral as to the intent of the bill, which is to give the city's flexibility, regardless of whether the date is 1993 or 2005 or 2013, or the size of the pipe, which original, that's what the bill said. I'm very familiar with this law, don't worry. I've been through a couple of cases about it. But I think, I'm not defending the law, I'm sorry. We do not believe that the concept of persistence is the kind of thing we need to do to take care of the fish. We think there are better ways. I don't know how persistence got there, it's there. Unfortunately, you're the folks that have to deal with it. But the tribes believe there are other methods, and the other method is let's define periods of stream flow, depending on the year, depending on what the natural flow is, what needs to be protected. We have the biologists, we have the hydrologists, we can help with that, and then the city can have much more flexibility how they use their water. It might mean storage, alternate sources. It might be what Salem has done, which is a massive groundwater aquifer storage program, which stores, by the way, as a legal authority to store 1 billion gallons of water. They're currently storing between 400 and 500 million gallons of water for use during periods when they can't use surface water diversion. So there are tools, and the tribe would support working with those tools. The tribe has good staff, they're dedicated, and of course, they have an understanding of this environment. With that, I think I'm available for questions if I can assist in any way.
Thank you very much, Reed. Let's hear from Tom, and then we'll come to
Chair Dembrough, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, Executive Director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited, here representing the members of Trout Unlimited. I'll just start with the statement that Trout Unlimited supports Water Watch in opposition to 2099, but of course we have great sympathy towards the cities. Now, if I can be blunt, as many of you know, I am roughly 5 weeks and 6 days away from retiring, and the last thing I wanted to do is be testifying before this committee for the last time ever about fish persistence, because I wake up with nightmares and shakes about this bill, because eventually I'm going to walk out of here, and no matter what I say, somebody from the lobby community is going to be glaring at me for what I just said. So this is an interesting topic, and I've always been the second string guy on this because Water Watch goes into the committee members and they come out, and I have to figure out what's going on from them. And I never cared for the concept of being second string, so here I am, the second string guy, coming up about a bill that has immense consequences both for fish and for cities at different levels. And having been born in the small town of Enterprise and living in 9 small towns across the state because my father was never satisfied with the coaching job he got until he ended up at Grant in Portland, which was the biggest city, the biggest high school football team at the time, I got to see a lot of rural Oregon. And I certainly understand the concerns of all of you here, but as a person that is among my 5 degrees, has a degree in fishery science, I understand the need of water for fish. There needs to be sufficient in-stream flow in order for fish to survive. And fish not only mean conservation in this state. Fishing, recreational fishing, is an over $1 billion industry in this state that we both from people, guides, city, restaurants, hotels, we bring in lots of money here. So the impact of having enough water in the streams has a tremendous impact on that industry. But like I said, this question I'm going to leave. I wish that we could solve this. I wish that I would be involved in this, and maybe we can get to a point that we can solve this session. I don't know. I know that I've been testifying a lot about this issue, and we've never come up with a good solution. So as this is the last time that I testify ever before many of you, and I appreciate, and I hope that you realize how much I appreciate all of you, the work and hard work you've done on this committee over the years. I wish I could come up with a better answer for you on how to solve this problem, but other than saying that fish need to be protected, we need to come up with a way to provide enough water for the fish, but yet for the cities. And I know that is a rather ambling, ambiguous statement, but it's the best I got. And please don't ask me any questions. Thank you.
Okay, colleagues, any questions for Tom?
Now that I know you're retiring, I got a question for you. Now, gentlemen, I agree with all three of you in what you've said today, but this is my concerns. The fish and the environment is very important. But the population is going to continue to grow at some rate. We don't know exactly how much. We can only predict. And cities are going to need to expand. And if we fast forward, if we don't find a solution now that we can protect the environment and supply water, in 50 years from now, somebody will be sitting at this dais, and there could be a big crowd of people out there that wants water. And I can guarantee you what that decision and who will win at that point. So going forward now is the time to start making those solutions, not 50 years from now, okay? We're going to have to supply water to the cities and to the people. But we have to do so in a way to also protect the environment. So it's not, no, you can't do this, we're going to do this. We have to do both. And that's the solution. Nobody has given me that solution today. That's what we need to be moving towards. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No, that's thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Vice Chair.
Mr. Wolf, I thank you for the service that you've done, because I've been here for 6 years now, and I see you all the time. It's remarkable, your comments. You're absolutely correct. The fishing industry is a very viable industry, bringing in a considerable amount of money. But measured to the amount of money that cities generate, I think it's minuscule. Not stating that I would want to see a decrease in our conservation and environmental issues with our fish, but I think that, as the good Senator Bertschreger said, that we have to find a balance, and it's up to us at this time, right now, to figure out how to make this work, because if we don't, we will have problems. Years, the good Senator
from Coos Bay has been doing this for years and years and years. It's incumbent upon us to come together and sit down and figure out how to make this work. As we all know, this year is a pretty robust water year. Perhaps we need to talk, as you did, sir, about storage, which we don't talk about much in this committee. We don't talk much anywhere about storage. Building more tanks, I would be just excited to see us build more reservoirs to store water so that we can control stream flows. But I think this is the time. The time is now that we fix this problem, because it's not going to be in the short session. It's not going to be 2 years from now. It's going to come down hard on us. And I think that it's time we all sat down and said, this is where we have to be. We have to remember that we have people that require water as well as fish.
So let me just clarify that what we're talking about here, as I understand it, is really those cities that are caught between the years 2005 and 2013. Those who are perfecting their water rights after 2013, who are diverting water after 2013, are complying with the fish persistence standards. They're doing it. They're finding a way to do it. Those that were before 2005, nobody has any, there are no issues. They don't have to do any fish persistence. Where there is murkiness is those cities that diverted between 2005 and 2013. In some cases, I suspect they were pushing the limits, not being totally sure that they were entitled to that water, but they did. In most cases, I think they legitimately thought they had a right, to that water without any conditions on it. But we've got to figure out a way to. So how do we deal with those, those cities that are in between? And that's what we're wrestling with here. And right now we are exploring two different sort of alternative strategies. One, which would be more like the one that Reed, I think you were proposing, which would be more flexible and that would look at a variety of techniques for finding an accommodation. And that's great, that's creative, and it makes a lot of sense if all goes well. But it also leaves some wiggle room for people in your profession. That is, that it leads potentially to lawsuits. So there's another school of thought that is arguing, well, let's just set the date at 2005 and say that, that becomes the cutoff date, and there is clarity there as a result. And this is something that I think we're still having conversations with. This is not a bill that we're going to be taking a vote on today. My hope is that we will be voting on a bill tomorrow. But we need to be looking at these, two alternatives, broadly speaking. Doesn't mean that within the next 24 hours we can't come up with some tweaks to them. But if we can't get there, then this will come back, I'm afraid. Tom.
Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Olson, Senator Barshager, I say this as a liberal progressive, but both Senator Olson and Senator Barshager are absolutely right. We do need to fix this now, and I will never admit that out of this room. But
you're on the record,
sir. Yeah. So it's in your hands, and like I said, I have great respect for you. So do what you need to do.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you.
Not for this group. I was going to have our other group come back, because I think there are some issues. You may have some other stuff, but I think there are some other issues besides the one you just mentioned.
Okay. Thank you, John.
At some point, we'll see if can they come back up, or do we have other people?
No, this was our last panel. Okay, let's Tracy, you want to come up and
rebuttal.
Be brief, because we want to move on.
But I think there are some issues embedded in this that are not just between 25 and
That's correct.
Chair Dembrough and Senator Roblin, that is correct. So just for the record, because again, this is a rather complicated, sordid history on this issue that right now, with no passage of the
bill. Could you identify yourself?
Yes,
again,
Tracy Retton, League of Oregon Cities. Thank you. Where we stand currently, if there is not a bill that does pass this legislative session, then the Court of Appeals ruling is what stands. And what the Court of Appeals decision in 2013 indicated is that they believe fish persistence should apply to the undeveloped portion of the permit. But their definition essentially of undeveloped portion of the permit is the last time the municipality had a processed extension of time. And this takes us back then to the 1990s, which is again why 1993 for the city of Philomath is the last time that they had a postcard extension processed by the department. So water developed between 1993 and 2005 is very much at play here. So we want to make sure that that's clear without a bill, that is a challenge. And then, of course, the 2005 to 2013, I wish the department would have been able to process 200 permits within a year. It's certainly not something that was able to happen. This is not a simple process to do fish persistence conditioning. And so, yes, people had to make investments during that time frame, and many of them weren't aware of a bill that passed in 2005, to be very honest. They hadn't heard from the department on these permits, again, for Philomath since 1993. And so they've been growing and developing water throughout that time, again, without a lot of certainty and knowledge of all these moving parts.
And Mr. Chair, Mark Landauer from the Special Districts Association of Oregon. My articulation of the impacted cities, I think, is better seen in a document that the Water Resources Department submitted for the record, page 3 of the background information, municipal extension on fish persistence. I want to just be sure that the record shows that the proper cities of winners and losers is identified on that particular document.
Okay, great. Thank you. Was there anything else, Senator? Okay.
Thank you
both. And actually, before we close this hearing, does the departments have any comments they'd like to make, Water Resources or ODF&W?
We're just here to answer questions if you have.
Okay.
Yeah. Bring them up.
Good choice.
Bring them up.
Okay, so with that, I will close our public hearing on House Bill 2099A, and we'll carry over the work session until tomorrow. Okay, so now I'm going to open our we have a work session on House Bill 2027A, and colleagues, we have, you'll remember this is the issue related to the prospective bridge on the Deschutes in the Bend area. And we have two competing amendments to consider. And I'm not sure that we'll be in a position to decide which way to go today. But I wanted to ask advocates for each side to come up and explain to us just what their amendments would do and be open to any questions we might have. So, Jael and Don, you want to come up? Yeah, why don't you both come up at the same time? Yeah. And colleagues, these are the A3 and A5? A4? Okay, A4 amendments. And these, so the A3 amendments are those coming from Ben Parks, I think, and the
A4 is the opposite.
It's the opposite. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, one is coming from one, and the other is coming
from the other.
There you go.
And what they have in common is both of them effectively prohibit the construction of a bridge within the urban growth boundary area of Bend and downstream.
Correct.
Yeah. One of them explicitly allows the construction of the bridge outside the urban growth boundary, that is on that federal, that forest forest land, the U.S. Forest Service parcel that was identified to us during the public hearing. The other is silent on that issue.
So clarification, when we had the presentation before, they actually showed us some maps and stuff where it potentially could cross over. Is that the second alternative that you just described as to that location being on the U.S. Forest?
The first of them would explicitly locate, would permit the bridge in that location, as I understand it. The second is silent as to where any bridge would go, if any bridge would go.
And who's making the decision? Is it going to be a local decision, or are we? Sounds like the first one we make the decision as to where it goes on the First Amendment. I'm just trying to get clarification.
Well,
yes.
Don, you want to present your?
You want me to start?
Yeah.
Senator Dembro and committee members, my name is Don Horton, and I'm the executive director for Bend Park and Recreation District. And thank you for having us back again today to help explain some of this to you. We're here in support of Amendment A4, and A4 is a two-paragraph amendment that you have, and it would specify a location for the bridge. I wanted to share with you a little bit that we've been looking at this for approximately 2 years, and we actually went through a bridge siting location with a community. We had 22 members on that committee. That process lasted 10 months, and we looked at 5 different bridge locations. And so the one that the committee recommended and our board has endorsed is the bridge that's before you today that is located on U.S. Forest Service property. The reason why we think that the amendment ought to include the bridge location is because in order for the Park and Recreation District to apply for a bridge location, we have to be the landowner. And that's what started us down this process in the first place. We've always intended for the bridge to be on federal property, and our board has always wanted a public project to be located on public property instead of private property. But we have to be the landowner in order for state parks to even accept an application. So it was through state parks' recommendation that we go through the process to see if we could change the rules to lift the bridge, the no bridge rule out of that. We've been through that process with state parks. That took approximately a year. It was a state parks run process. But what the state parks looked at wasn't just the bridge. They looked at all 8 rules that are a part of this, and they chose not to reopen rules. So that still leaves us with this no bridge rule that we need to work with. By allowing the bridge to be located on federal property, it has some benefits that we believe. The first benefit is it assures that the bridge is not going to be located on private property. And I think that was the number one concern of some of the local residents, was the possibility that bridge could be located on their property or on private property in general. So this takes that completely off the table, because part of that amendment would not allow for a bridge to be within the UGB. By specifying on a Forest Service property, it would legislate only within a very narrow 520-foot span where that bridge could be located. And so what our proposal is, it would go from the urban growth boundary within a 520-foot length of distance upstream and be wholly located on U.S. Forest Service property. So that would help us by getting around the no bridge rule. And it would allow the Forest Service to allow us to begin a NEPA process. So part of what you heard in testimony was, what are the environmental consequences of putting a bridge in this location? The NEPA process will help us determine what those environmental concerns are and what we can do to mitigate those if, in fact, that there are any environmental concerns. So that in a very quick synopsis, that's the reason why we are asking you to support Amendment 4A, A4.
Thank you. JL?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Dembro. Members of the committee, for the record, JL Wilson, representing the proponents of House Bill 2027. We obviously support the bill in its entirety, but it was suggested to me that perhaps we might look at another alternative. And so our alternative is the -A3 amendment. And as you recall, House Bill 2027 prohibited, all it does is lifts current OAR into Oregon Revised Statute. There's no new language there. It is simply putting a rule in statute. It treated 2 different sections of the state scenic waterway on the upper Deschutes, one within the urban growth boundary, one upstream from the urban growth boundary to the south. Our language simply similar to the A4s. It's exactly the same in this regard. It prohibits the bridge within the UGB. Where we differ is our amendment is simply silent upstream from the UGB to the south. So it does not explicitly prohibit a bridge, but it does not say a bridge cannot be built. It simply remains silent. We think functionally there's a lot of similarities between the two. I think stylistically there are problems. Politically, I think there are problems with the A4. I think we all understand coalition politics. The A4 would certainly cause the environmental community to drop off their support. And I think that there are significant concurrence issues on the other side. But with respect to the policy, I think functionally the policy obviously within the UGB is the same. We just remain silent outside of the UGB.
So I have two things I would like to add. One thing that the House committee did not have an opportunity to hear because the information wasn't available at the time is we've done some polling since it went through the House, and the polling is a part of our comprehensive plan update. And one of the questions in our comprehensive plan update poll was, do you support the bridge in this specific location? 72% of the respondents said they do support the bridge, 14% were opposed to it, and the remainder was silent. You know, they were undecided on whether or not they supported a bridge or not. So that was information that was not available at the time that this went before the House. And the other is to address the environmental issues. During the last hearings, you heard a lot about elk migration. This is not within the elk migration. Elk migration starts about a mile upstream and goes towards Sun River. It's also not in the spotted frog habitat, which you heard last time. Spotted frog habitat is in the Old Mill District in Bend. Other than that, it starts at about Meadow Camp, if you're familiar with that area, which is also about a mile upstream and goes all the way up into the lakes and the Cascade Lakes. So, and then I think it's also really important to understand that the location where we're choosing to put the bridge is an off-leash dog area. And it's the largest off-leash dog area in Bend with the highest visitation of people with their dogs off-leash. And in the Deschutes National Forest Plan, they call for this to be intense recreational use with the possibility of building more trails in this area. So we believe that we're consistent with the Deschutes National Forest Service plan. And at this point, absent a NEPA study, we do not believe that there's any significant environmental consequences as a result of the bridge. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Brzezinski.
I wonder if Beth could just walk us through the two different amendments. I'm trying to do a quick review of the first paragraphs in both of those. They look to be close to the same.
They're identical.
If not identical.
Yeah.
So can I follow up?
Please.
So, JL, you're under the A3, you're saying that where the A4 calls for the bridge to be built, it could, in fact, be built there. It just wouldn't be prescribed?
It wouldn't be prescribed. Thank you, Chair Dembro, Senator Brzezinski. It wouldn't be prescribed. They would still have to go through the OPRD process because there is still a rule prohibition against bridges in the state scenic waterway. And the effect of the dash 4 is it would in essence, bypass that OPRD process because the prescription's already in statute.
So we, if I can follow up, yes. So we through the A4 would, let's say, give them the pass through that part of the process. Your clients would not be able to contest it through that process.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Although that process, is this the rule that then after a year, it doesn't need to be followed? Is that how that
Thank
works?
Thank you. It's what's known as the non-conforming use provision. And the recent a process the OPRD went through was specifically that stretch of river within the UGB, and that's what OPRD specifically declined to open up the rulemaking on just a couple weeks ago. But again, that we're talking about a different segment of the river. So both amendments, in essence, reinforce the OPRD decision to some effect. That the I'm assuming that the Parks and Rec Department would have to reengage OPRD for this particular bridge location upstream from the UGB.
Yeah, I agree with JL on that, with the one exception that in order for us to apply, we have to be the landowner. And we can't be the landowner of federal property. And so that's kind of our catch-22. You know, by taking this position of allowing the bridge in that location, it would take the state parks piece out of it and require that we work directly with the federal government in the NEPA process.
Starting to shed some light on this. So, JL, how do you respond to that? I mean, would you argue that that's not a legitimate concern?
No, I wouldn't argue that at all.
But you would argue,
yes,
you would argue that the environmental people would probably not be as happy with that opt-out.
Thank you, Chair Dembro and Senator Roble. I can't think of a single environmental group that would support a bill that actively prescribes a bridge across a state scenic waterway.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions of these two?
No.
Okay. Well, thank you both for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My sense is that we're not ready to vote on this just yet. And so I'd
you
like
got good sense,
Chair.
Yeah.
We got another.
That's another.
I've got a 10:30 1:30 tea time tomorrow.
So we will be in consultation over this one.
Okay.
Yeah, we're going to carry over 2027 till tomorrow. Close that work session. Okay, let's open our work session on House Bill 2031A. And this is the Metolius Resort. Looking at perhaps moving it to Clatsop County.
That's the base bill. Right.
That's the base bill. It had a number of desired passengers. my inclination, gentlemen, is to go with. We have two proposals that are without controversy, and those are the A4s and the A8s.
A6s.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
A4 and A6.
A4 and A6.
I'm sorry. It's A6 and A8.
A6 yes. and A8.
Thank you. Now you're, I keep, you had me confused.
Sorry.
That's okay.
Why don't we open those and.
Mr. Chair, I see that we have two A6s, one dated 524 and one dated 531.
Well, just follow the script, and you'll be okay. It's the only way I can make sense out of it.
What happened to the A3s?
I see that, but I'm trying to look, and there is no A6 dated 517.
I believe what you're looking at is the date it was posted, perhaps. The date on the amendment is 517.
Okay. Yeah. I got you.
Yes.
So we're on that one. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So why don't you move it, Vice Chair, and then Beth can explain it.
Okay. Chair Dembro, I move to adopt the dash A6 amendment dated 5/17/17.
Did we open the session?
Mm-hmm. Vice Chair Olson has moved to adopt the A6 amendments dated May 17, 2017. Beth, can you tell us what this amendment does?
Mr. Chair, members, this amendment would change the amount of time that a resort site owner is allowed in order to apply to the county for approval of a small-scale recreation community from 5 to 3 years after the effective date of the act. It also removes the list of 5 counties where those communities may be established and instead has a list of the 21 counties where they may be established. And then finally, this amendment declares an emergency so that that clock can start ticking right away.
Okay. Discussion, colleagues? Okay, is there any objection to our adopting the A6 amendments? Seeing none, so ordered.
Okay. Chair Dembrough, I move to adopt the dash A8 amendment dated 5/18/17.
Okay, Vice Chair Olson has moved to adopt the dash A8 amendments dated 5/18/17. And Beth, what does this one do?
Mr. Chair, the A8 amendments would direct the county weed inspector to notify the county court rather than the district attorney, as the law currently reads, if a landowner occupant fails or refuses to immediately destroy or cut noxious weeds in accordance with the law, and then directs the county court to take steps to enforce the law.
Okay. Colleagues, any discussion of this?
Could be.
Is there any objection to our adopting the A8 amendments? Okay, so ordered. Vice Chair.
I'm just making notes.
Yeah.
Chair Dembrough, I move House Bill 2031A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Olson moves House Bill 2031A as amended by the A6 and A8 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion carries.
I will.
Okay. Vice Chair Olson will carry. Okay. I'll close the work session on 2031. And let's open our work session on 2722. And colleagues, this is the one about irrigation requirements at HOAs during times of drought. And yeah, why don't you go ahead and do that?
Okay. Questions. Chair Dembrough, I move to adopt the dash one amendment dated 5/24/17.
Vice Chair Olson has moved to adopt the dash one amendments dated 5/24/17. Beth, you want to tell us what these do?
Mr. Chair, members, the dash one is a conflict amendment. House Bill 3447 has already passed the body and amends the same section of statute. So this amendment just resolves any conflicts between the two measures.
Okay. This is a technical amendment. Anybody have any questions? Okay. Is there any objection to our adopting these conflict amendments? Seeing none, so ordered. Vice Chair?
Well,
second strings here.
So you don't get contaminated just by saying that. You don't have to vote for it.
All right, so we're going to
call. Well, I just, yeah.
We got the ones in, right?
Yeah.
So we're going to go ahead and, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2722 as amended by the dash one amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you.
Yeah, you bet.
Senator Brzozinski has moved House Bill 2722 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I did pass over and allow the good senator to read, to move the bill to the floor, because I don't agree with it. And the reason I don't, I feel it broaches contractual obligations between condominium owners, and that concerns me when we can pass laws to change a contract for someone that might have been there for 15 years. We talk about this all the time. We talk about it with PERS. We're not allowed to change contracts, and I think that this does. So I'll be a no on this bill.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following suit with my colleague, Senator Olson, my problem with this bill is not the issue of, water management or whatever. It's, again, a contractual. When you're in a homeowners association or a condominium association or whatever, and you buy and you purchase and you have that contract, there may be some people that purchased in that homeowners association because they knew everybody's going to have a green lawn. Okay? So there's two sides to this, and I think it's a real sticky pathway for the legislature to be interrupting contractual law. So I will be a no on it also.
Yeah. I appreciate those comments, and we've had several HOA bills this session. And I don't know if it's coincidental that we have a new representative who was himself the attorney for a number of HOAs for many years, but you will remember Representative Isle came and presented this bill to us. It's I think an open question as to when, you know, the extent to which people living in an HOA should have different expectations than everyone else. I mean, we voted on a bill this morning having to do with solar. You know, we want to promote solar, and we want to promote water conservation in times of declared drought. That's something that seems to me should apply to everyone everywhere, irrespective of what contractual relations they have. I don't know, but I think that this is an issue. When we had our public hearing, I remember Senator Przanski, suggesting that maybe we need to look at the way that the threshold for changing those HOA rules, which we heard require a 75% vote, maybe that's too high. This is an issue, obviously, that goes beyond this committee, but I think there's probably more work to be done in this area. With that, why don't you call the roll, Shelley?
Senator Barrett Sugar?
No.
Senator Przanski?
Aye.
Senator Roblin?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
No.
Chair Dembrough?
Aye. Okay, the motion carries. I'll carry the bill to the floor. Since the vice chair didn't jump right in.
He's thinking about it.
Yeah. Okay, close the work session on 2722. Open our work session on House Bill 2730. And we have no amendments for this one. So, Beth, why don't you remind us what this does?
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 2730A would allow a golf course on land determined to be high-value farmland located west of U.S. Highway 101, surrounded on all sides by an approved golf course and not otherwise described in law.
Pretty specific.
Very good.
Okay. Vice Chair.
Chair Dimmerer, I move House Bill 2730 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. You notice my exuberance. It's a golf course.
Vice Chair Olson moves House Bill 2730 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion of this bill?
I think that the patch that's not there is a bass reserve, but now it'll be part of the golf resort, so that's good.
So that'll be a water hazard?
Keep it up.
Okay, colleagues, is there any objection to this bill? Seeing none, so ordered. Motion carries. Anybody want to carry it?
I'll take it.
Okay, Senator Barrett
Trigger. Easy one.
Isn't Senator Roblin want to carry this one?
It's just south of me, but I'm fine. It's just east. It's just a little bit west of him, so we're good. We're good here.
I think it's closer than you.
You might be.
Okay, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2730. So, Beth, 2785, is that?
They're not quite ready.
Okay.
No fiscal yet.
All right. I'm going to carry over House Bill 2785. We're still waiting for paperwork. And open our work session on House Bill 3012. And this, too, I think is unamended.
Correct. Chair Denver, I move House Bill 3012A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Olson has moved House Bill 3012A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Beth, remind us what this one does.
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 3012A would authorize a county to allow the owner of property within an area zone for rural residential use to construct a new single-family dwelling on the lot or parcel subject to certain conditions. in converting a historic home on the same lot or parcel to an ADU.
Okay. We heard this bill last week. Any discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Okay, motion carries. Anybody want to carry this one?
I can carry this one.
Okay, Senator Brzozinski will carry. Close the work session on House Bill 3012.
So, Mr. Chair,
yeah,
I know you just closed. We did have some discussions on 3012 as to whether there's going to be any requirement to put any type of notice into the deed or any type of acknowledgement. I'm just assuming we didn't do that.
No.
Okay.
Right.
You're right.
I mean, it's kind of like concern of the buyers beware as to what mm-hmm. they think they're getting until they have signed on the dotted line. But I
you
mean,
know, Floyd, we have the same situation in, I'll give you an example on a, if you own a farm and you want to have family members help on the farm, then you're able to construct another dwelling for that. But then when that arrangement all goes away, the next thing you know is you have a rental.
Right.
It's the same thing.
Right. Okay.
Thank you.
Is that okay, colleagues? I mean,
yeah,
we could reopen
and seek
an amendment.
I think our laws, they can't subdivide it, though, right?
That's my understanding, is they cannot.
They cannot. As long as they cannot subdivide it, I'm okay there. I don't want them selling off one and the other.
Well, the reality is if the situation goes away, the government's not going to make them tear one of the houses
down. Right.
It's just simply not
right.
going to happen.
Right. Yeah.
We're good. Okay.
Okay. So our final bill, is this ready to go?
No.
3245.
Not quite. We're waiting for paperwork as well.
So
there's an amendment.
There's an amendment mm-hmm. that seems to be,
as far as I know, seems to be people are happy.
I'm not sure.
You're not sure.
I haven't read the line.
Okay. So there's still a little bit of vetting to do, I think, on the A6. No. I'm
it's
sorry, the 8-4.
Okay.
It's not posted, is it?
It should be.
I don't see it.
It's
no, it's not. I will do that right now. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, in any case, we're going to carry it over.
All right. So my understanding just...
okay. Yeah. So we're carrying over House Bill 3245.
And the 2785, I'm assuming that's also being carried over?
Yes.
Yep, I'm ready to do that. Yes.
I didn't have that.
Yeah.
I didn't hear him say that one.
Yes.
2027.
Actually, I didn't mention 2711, which is the fracking moratorium. This one we won't be carrying over.
No, I understand. Yeah, what I have carried over are the first two, 2099, 2027. And what I didn't hear was 2785. Apparently you did toward the bottom of the page.
I think he did, but why don't you just review
the
carry?
Yeah, I'll just reiterate. Those that we're carrying over for tomorrow are 2099, 2027, 2785, and
3245.
Yep. Okay. Let the record show. Okay, colleagues, with that, we're adjourned until 1 o'clock tomorrow.
Thank you.
1 o'clock tomorrow.
Thank you.
Until 1 o'clock.